Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. The California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, the Westlands Water District has reached a deal with the federal government to settle a drainage dispute that goes back decades. The only problem? It needs to be approved by Congress. We'll find out why the bill was included and then removed from a $700 billion defense authorization bill, and what the prospects are for actually getting it through the U.S. Capitol. We'll also dig into the history of what we know about Valley Fever and learn why Lemoore Naval Air Station has played a critical role in advancing our knowledge of that disease. And we'll talk with California gubernatorial candidate Delaine Easton and find out why she says California Governor Jerry Brown isn't doing enough to lead on education. Plus, the local Latina teens who are dominating the sport of boxing. That's all coming up later in our show. We begin, though, in one of Fresno's oldest neighborhoods, Chinatown. From the city's earliest days as a stop on the Central Pacific Railroad to the 21st century, Chinatown has been a diverse community made up of immigrants who, in many cases, weren't allowed in other parts of Fresno. Locked in by railroad tracks on the east and Highway 99 to the west, the neighborhood is also the subject of renewed attention this year as two of the state's highest-profile projects, high-speed rail and cap and trade, call it Ground Zero. We sent Valley Public Radio's Laura Tsutsui there to talk to business owners old and new to hear what they have to say about all the activity.
Ophelia Heme owns a restaurant and barbershop on Kern Street in the heart of Chinatown.
And I've been right here in Chinatown for 43 years.
3 years ago, she opened her restaurant called Ophelia's Cocina. They serve Mexican food, their most popular item being their wet burritos.
It's a asada burrito with a grain sauce and cheese, melted cheese on top.
Next door is Ophelia's and Sons Barbershop, which she opened 25 years ago. And before that, Ophelia worked at a number of Chinatown establishments, a bakery, a meat market, a tortilla shop.
For 20 years, I've been around here before doing business, and I always liked this area.
Ophelia has seen Chinatown change. She says the area struggles with a large homeless population and a bad reputation that Ophelia says isn't accurate.
I mean, I just say, you know, tell people, don't be afraid to come and do business in here. It's not that bad. If you hear bad things, forget about the bad things. Come in and experience yourself, and you will like it.
Now, the area is facing a different kind of change. Two state projects are affecting Chinatown, high-speed rail and cap-and-trade money. These projects are creating new opportunities, but also mean a new set of challenges.
We see a lot of changes, and it hasn't been that good. But like I said, we've been faithful, we were here, and whatever happens, we'll still be here.
One of those challenges is access. From outside Ophelia's restaurant, you can see that a section of Kern Street is closed, blocking access from downtown Fresno. This new closure is to accommodate high-speed rail construction. Ophelia, like other Chinatown business owners, hopes that these projects play a role in revitalizing the area. But it will take years before they are complete. Construction of high-speed rail is taking place along the railroad that separates downtown from Chinatown. The work has closed three streets that would connect the two neighborhoods, and two of those streets will eventually close for good. Tony Tinoco with the High Speed Rail Authority says that they have been doing outreach in Chinatown for months.
We've even attended some of the Chinatown community meetings that they have on their own, where they've invited us to come and speak, talk about some of these closures, and understand what's going to come for the next year and a half or 2 years.
The Central Valley corridor of high-speed rail is supposed to be running by 2025. Next to Ophelia's restaurant is China Alley. Another upcoming change is that the historic alleyway will be repaved using cap-and-trade money from the state. The Transformative Climate Communities Program designated how the cap-and-trade money be invested in areas of Fresno. In Chinatown, TCC money will go to improving roads and greenery in the area. Another major TCC project will be a mixed-use housing development. The Fresno Housing Authority will use $10 million of TCC money to develop their first housing project in Chinatown. Preston Prince is the CEO of the Housing Authority.
We started working with community members and business owners, primarily business owners, to talk about how does our development match up with the revitalization goals of Chinatown.
The project will create 57 housing units. They're planning a four-story building with three floors of apartments and townhomes along Mariposa Street.
Yeah, so it's really going to be a neighborhood, a little higher density than most, but a neighborhood that many people would like to live in.
The housing development is projected to be complete in 2020, and other TCC projects have to be completed by 2021. Besides future improvements to Chinatown, TCC had another impact. The collaborative process of deciding how to spend the money motivated many Chinatown business owners to get involved.
Prior to this process, there was no organization in Chinatown that was intact.
Morgan Doazaki runs Central Fish, a Japanese market in Chinatown that has been in his family since 1950. Doazaki and other business owners are trying to keep the momentum by establishing the Chinatown-Fresno Partnership. The partnership would assist Chinatown property and business owners and help revitalize the area.
We're forming this organization. We do have a stronger voice. We have plenty of people from the community moving forward to, claim back what we used to have a voice on.
It hasn't just been longtime business owners who see Chinatown's potential, but new ones as well. Arthur Moy is the CEO of Full Circle Brewery, a role he's held for the last year. During TCC meetings, he had to temper his enthusiasm when working with longtime business owners.
It was a humbling experience, you know, because I'm just optimistic by nature. So coming in cheerleading, you know, they're like, who are you? You know, who's your family? You know, my family's been here for 100 years. I had to change the strategy as to how to speak to the community and really just listen.
Moy hopes a partnership helps businesses stay informed and prepare for the changes to come. But even with high-speed rail and TCC projects, the area still struggles with homelessness.
It's very dense and not representative of the population elsewhere in Fresno. So that draws down, property values and safety, and not always safety, but definitely the perception of safety.
Despite these challenges, Moy is still optimistic.
You know, there's an urban scene that's brewing here, and it's downtown and Chinatown.
In Moy's words, maybe Chinatown is just coming full circle. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
This is Valley Edition. One of the challenges in preventing and treating the fungal disease Valley Fever is that much about the disease remains unknown. And much of what we do know stems from work done over 70 years ago, when early disease research was supported not only by Stanford University and local health departments, but also a farther-reaching agency with much deeper pockets. FM 89's Carrie Klein reports from a small San Joaquin Valley city with a long history of the disease.
Almost everyone in the city of Lemoore has a story about Valley Fever. Take Frank Bernhardt, drinking a beer at the Fleet Reserve Bar on the edge of town. He first encountered the disease in the 1960s.
Years ago, my youngest daughter had it. She just didn't have no energy.
Across the bar, Kevin Cronover is playing dice with some buddies.
I had a sailor that worked for me that had it. He was over at the base hospital.
Both Bernhardt and Cronover served at Naval Air Station Lemoore, the Navy's largest jet base in the country. Looking out at the airstrips cutting through dusty fields of cotton and corn, it's no surprise that the naval base struggles with this desert disease, caused when people breathe in spores from a fungus that lives in the soil. Kings County, where Lemoore is located, ranks consistently among California's three worst counties for Valley Fever. And from 2000 to 2013, Lemoore had the highest number of cases of any military base in the country. But the air station's history with Valley Fever begins much earlier, in the mid-20th century, when military researchers teamed up with a prominent epidemiologist to study the disease. This collaboration resulted in a wealth of Valley Fever data and trends, and a legacy of research that still informs how we approach the disease today.
The expansion of knowledge of the disease was very importantly supported by military contribution.
Dr. Demosthenes Papagiannis runs a Valley Fever testing lab at UC Davis and has been studying the disease since the 1950s. He says as the military expanded into the San Joaquin Valley at the start of World War II, leaders brought in Dr. Charles Smith, a Stanford physician who pioneered Valley Fever research. He came armed with a skin test that could detect immunity to the disease. Beginning in 1941, Smith skin tested every service member stationed at four bases in the valley, including Lemoore, which at that time belonged to the Army. Smith also had access to prisoners of war, many of whom were hospitalized with the disease. Sandra Larson is former director of the nonprofit Valley Fever Americas and an unofficial Valley Fever historian.
So it was an ideal laboratory, ideal place to find out a lot about the occurrence of Valley Fever and how often it happened and how quickly it happened.
This tremendous patient base allowed Smith to confirm all sorts of important details about Valley Fever incidence and infectiousness.
So the military has been crucial in all of this. Their interest brought it to a national attention, and that's something that we're still working at today, is getting that national attention.
Since those studies ended in 1946, the military's involvement in Valley Fever research has waxed and waned. It peaked with vaccine development in the 1980s, which ultimately stalled. Earlier this year, the Navy was awarded a small grant for a blood serum study to understand exposure rates. Even if the military's interest levels haven't endured, so much of that early research has. Smith's findings from World War II still shape our basic understanding of Valley Fever, including maps of where the disease naturally occurs. Plus, the military made some of the earliest discoveries in dust control related to the disease. Since the war, Valley Fever incidence throughout the military has dropped by an order of magnitude, from over 10 cases per 100,000 service members down to less than 3. Over a 14-year period, from 2000 to 2013, Naval Air Station Lemoore reported 62 cases of the disease. It may not sound like a huge number, but it's still the highest reported by any U.S. military installation during that time period. Dr. Ryan Maves is an infectious disease expert at Naval Medical Center San Diego.
We see periodic cases from Fort Irwin or from 29 Palms or from Yuma or just from San Diego, but Lemoore is really one of the, you know, the military's epicenter of Valley Fever.
The Navy has not shared base-specific data since 2013, but a doctor at Lemoore claims their case rate today is similar to that seen in surrounding Kings County, meaning they could see anywhere from a small handful to a few dozen cases per year. The military officials I spoke with don't seem alarmed by those numbers. Maeve says prevention is difficult when the disease simply travels in the air.
There's only so much dust reduction one can do on a base with supersonic jets taking off from it.
That's why at Lemoore, the focus is instead on education and outreach. Dr. Francis Hall, director of public health on base, says every provider at their shiny, cavernous naval hospital has to take coursework in recognizing and treating Valley Fever. Plus, all sailors have to sit through a mandatory lecture on the disease.
There's no instruction saying that we have to do this. We just think it's in the best interest of our population, given the fact that the bulk of them are not from this area.
Other institutions do take pointed preventive measures. For instance, the California State Prison System has seen huge drops in Valley Fever cases since it began relocating inmates out of the valley based on their ethnicity and skin test results. Hall says that's just not practical in the Navy. On the other hand, he says the Navy does take pre-existing health conditions into account when choosing where to station sailors. And at Lemoore specifically, some protective measures are built into the job.
Much of the work done at this base is around aircraft, because this is the F-18 base. And when people are working around the aircraft, they typically wear respirators.
Sandra Larson appreciates how important the military was to early disease research, but she wishes its role today was greater.
Maybe until the Surgeon General himself gets the disease, maybe there won't be that much interest. but I'm hoping that eventually the military could be interested in helping to fund the cure.
She ventures, if they got involved with vaccine development once, they could do it again. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The future of California Governor Jerry Brown's plan to build two massive tunnels underneath the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta remains uncertain. A big issue remains the current opposition from the Westlands Water District. The farmers who make up the state's largest irrigation district balked at the project's $17 billion price tag, despite promises it could make water deliveries from Northern California more reliable than they currently are. The Department of the Interior has also said it won't help pay for the project, which might get scaled down to just one tunnel. But at the same time as that debate continues, Westlands growers are also watching another issue very closely involving water, the issue of drainage. Legislation authorizing a settlement between the U.S. government and Westlands over a decades-old drainage problem is currently in Congress. It almost got approved as part of a defense authorization bill. Here to tell us more, we have with us Emily Benson from High Country News. Emily, welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, Emily, why is drainage an issue in the first place? Does gravity not apply here in the San Joaquin Valley? Why is this a big deal?
Sure. So in parts of the San Joaquin Valley, irrigation water can get trapped by a layer of impermeable clay that's in the ground. And so that means the water accumulates in the soil instead of draining deeper underground. And that can smother crop roots. Excess dissolved salts in the water can damage plants. When those salts, especially selenium, are concentrated enough, that can become lethal for wildlife that encounters it, so particularly birds.
And that was a big problem decades ago with the Kesterson Reservoir and wildlife refuge there, where many birds died. Is that really at the heart of this problem also?
Yeah. So in 1968, the federal government started building a drain to try to get rid of this excess water. And that drain was intended to reach all the way to the Sacramento-San Joaquin Bay Delta, but it was never finished. So it drained into the Kesterson Reservoir. And when enough selenium had collected in the 1980s, the early 1980s, hundreds of ducks and other waterfowl died at Kesterson. And in fact, many bird embryos never developed the right way. They never hatched. And they had severe abnormalities, missing eyes, missing beaks, things like that.
So what would this new agreement do to avoid those problems in the future if it is actually approved by Congress?
Right. So if the agreement was approved, then that would transfer responsibility for dealing with this issue to Westlands and away from the federal government. So Westlands, they probably wouldn't build a new drain. There are a number of different ways that you can deal with this issue. You can retire some land from irrigation altogether. That's probably the easiest or cheapest way to deal with the problem. Or you can collect that salt-laden water and try to reuse it in different ways. You can grow more salt-tolerant crops. You can also, and Westlands has already been doing this, you can also try to make sure that you are irrigating as efficiently as possible by using sprinklers or drip irrigation or things like that. And of course, if you're being more efficient, then that means that there's less runoff coming off the farm fields, so you get less of this drainage problem.
And I want to get into some of the other implications of this in a second, because this also involves Westlands water supply. What does that mean? How does that work into this agreement as well?
Right. So there were a number of aspects of the agreement. The Westlands and the federal government negotiated back and forth. And part of that was that Westlands agreed to take a 25% reduction in their allocation of water from the Central Valley Project.
And that's a reduction of what they're promised to receive. Of course, many of us who follow that here in the Valley know that they've only received a fraction, or in the recent drought, a couple of years where they got none of that allocation. And this would also make their water supply permanent rather than a two-year authorization. Is that correct?
Yeah, so right now their water allocation, that agreement is renewed every couple of years. And that's because they're still paying back the debt that was incurred when the Central Valley Project was built. But as part of this agreement, that debt would be, they would be forgiven from that debt. And in these kinds of contracts, when the district no longer has any debt, then their water allocation contract becomes permanent. So that's why that would happen.
Now, on the other hand, Westland says this deal would relieve the federal government of the obligation of funding that cleanup. So I guess there's a financial incentive both ways?
That's right.
So what are other groups saying on this? And what's Westland saying? And I want to also get into some of the environmental groups and even Native American tribes. First of all, what does Westland say about this process as it's moving forward right now?
Yeah, well, you know, they say that they, you know, they're the experts at managing this resource, and they and the federal government negotiated and came to this agreement that works for both of them. And I do want to say this deal was finalized in 2015, so it was actually negotiated under the Obama administration. They say, you know, we have this deal, it's good for both sides. All we need is congressional approval, so let's just get that done.
Now, as with anything involving water in California, as with anything involving the Westlands Water District, just due to its significant size, controversy follows. What are environmental groups and this Native American tribe saying about this?
Sure. So environmental groups are just, you know, they're concerned about turning over management to Westlands. They say that they don't think that Westlands is going to have fish in the environment, you know, as their main priority when they're putting their plans into place to deal with this issue. So that's their main concern. And as for Native American tribes, the Hoopa Valley tribe, in addition to some other groups, they oppose this settlement because they kind of see it as just another part of this decades-long history of fights, basically, between Westlands and tribes and water managers in the north. The Hoopa Valley tribe, they see this as a bid to just get more control over water in the north.
And again, in California, most of the precipitation falls in the north, and most of the demand is in the central and southern parts of the state. How does this issue of the defense bill fit in here? Because it seems like an odd fit. This was in the $700 billion defense authorization bill that Congress passed a few weeks ago, but it didn't make the final version. What happened there?
That's right. So this the finalization of the settlement was included in that bill as a rider. And that's because the settlement needs congressional approval to become finalized. And that's because it involves a change to a law that authorized the San Luis Drainage Unit. So for the settlement to be finalized, it needs congressional approval, and lawmakers have been unable to get this settlement passed on its own. So some of them now are trying to attach it to any kind of legislation that they can to get it passed before a January 15th deadline that's coming up.
You talked to Johnny Amaral of Westlands. Are they optimistic that this is going to get through before the end of the year, or are they seeing that as a setback?
Well, you know, I think it's anybody's guess. It's hard to predict what's going on in Washington, but they are, you know, Westland says that they're just going to keep trying. They're going to try to get this passed any way that they can.
Again, we've been talking with Emily Benson. She's a writer for High Country News, and she has been reporting on the agreement between the Westlands Water District and the United States government that would make big changes in the way that Westlands receives its water allocations and who was responsible for cleaning up the drainage problem that has plagued that part of the valley with agricultural runoff for decades and many years ago contributed to the big problems at the Kesterson Wildlife Refuge. Again, you can find Emily's reporting online at High Country News. Emily, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And stay with us on Valley Edition. We'll be back in just a moment and find out what's happening to an important children's health insurance program that's vital to many in the Valley. and also talk with California gubernatorial candidate Delaine Easton. That's all coming up on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. When it comes to the healthcare safety net, there's been a lot of uncertainty in the last few months. Republican lawmakers spent the better part of the year trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and funding has been on shaky ground for community health centers that treat low-income and uninsured patients. Today, we're talking about the Children's Health Insurance Program, a program that insures 9 million American kids that is also now in jeopardy. To talk more about that, we have with us FM 89 healthcare reporter Carrie Klein. Carrie, welcome.
Hi, Joe.
So what is CHIP?
So CHIP is it's a children's health insurance program. It's a federal program that provides health insurance coverage to kids in low-income families and some pregnant moms in low-income families. It's ostensibly for families that make too much money to qualify for Medicaid or Medi-Cal, as it's called in California, but can't necessarily afford private insurance. So the federal government provides the lion's share of the funding, but each state administers the program itself. And here in California, it's actually been rolled into Medi-Cal. So what's really interesting is that a lot of patients may not actually know that they're beneficiaries of the CHIP program. They just think they're on Medi-Cal. But the program, you know, today covers 9 million kids in the U.S. and 2 million of those are here in California. So it's pretty huge.
So why is it in the news right now?
Well, for right now, the program, the future of the program is uncertain because Congress, for right now, has let it lapse. So the program was set to sunset at the end of September, and that deadline passed without a vote from Congress. So for right now, there is a chance that Congress could renew the program, pass something to renew and reauthorize the program. But for right now, states have lost their federal funding. Have been relying on reserve funds. So many states have been able to sock away some funding for this, but you know we're all set to run out in the next couple of months, and it's looking like California is likely to run out of its funds the end of this month or early January.
So why is this particular program a part of this political fight right now? We hear both representatives on the Republican and Democratic side of the aisle voice support for what the program does. Why is it such a hot potato right now?
Yeah, I know, right? Because nobody can argue that kids don't deserve medical coverage. But basically, the program is expensive. It cost the federal government almost $16 billion in 2017. And, there's the perennial calls from many lawmakers that this just costs too much money. But then it's a partisan issue. Democrats and Republicans can't agree on where the funding should come from. So lawmakers have promised to come up with this funding solution by the end of the year. But they've been saying that since the summer when the original September deadline was looming. And there has been some recent legislation. You know, in early November, the House passed a bill to renew CHIP for 5 years, but it was pretty partisan. It took some money for the program out of the Affordable Care Act. It included some cuts to other social programs. And so it wasn't popular with a lot of lawmakers. That particular bill is unlikely to get enough votes in the Senate. And apparently also yesterday, House Republicans introduced a 2-week continuing resolution to keep the government running, and it included a short-term measure to uphold CHIP while lawmakers kind of figure out the nuts and bolts of the funding. But that particular measure hasn't passed yet, and even if it does, it's still only a 2-week measure, and the health community would, you know, continue its nail biting without a more permanent solution.
So that's the political story out of Washington. What does it mean on the ground here in California?
Well, it's pretty big. As I said, the program covers about 2 million kids in California. And it means, you know, if there's no reauthorization, California would run out of the funds that it's reserved for this occasion. But that doesn't mean that the program would end. Because California rolled CHIP into Medi-Cal, we are actually legally obligated to continue the program until October 2019. So these kids would continue to get their coverage, and it means the state would have to make up for that funding elsewhere in the state budget. And that would likely mean, you know, pulling funds from other programs. The federal government provides, as I said, the lion's share of the funding in California. That's $2.7 billion that the feds provide. But in kind of an interesting technicality, kind of some complicated math here, the state does not have to make up all $2.7 billion of that, because these patients would just continue to get covered under normal Medi-Cal, and there is still a federal cost share for that. It's less, so the state would have to pay more for those patients than they would under CHIP, but the state would only have to make up kind of the difference in the federal cost share rather than all $2.7 billion.
So what does this mean for patients? Are they getting notifications that this program has, at least the funding for the program has lapsed? What's going on?
Nope, not yet. And it's pretty unclear what it's going to mean for the patients in the future. There are some states that have been sending out letters already that, you know, basically the program is uncertain, because there are some states that would stop the program immediately if it ran out of funds. California is not in that position. So no, they have not been getting letters yet. And like I said, since the program would continue until at least October of 2019, presumably these patients would still get their coverage. But of course, it's, you know, the state may decide to not cover all of them and change the qualifications. That's not entirely clear. Or if it does cover all of them, if the state does have to take away funding from other programs, maybe we would feel them in other ways and different patients would feel cuts to their coverage. So it's really, the future is pretty uncertain.
So what are people who are actually involved in the healthcare world saying about this?
Well, people in the healthcare world are pretty unhappy about it. You know, like I said, it's pretty hard to argue that kids don't deserve medical coverage, especially kids in low-income families. And certainly lawmakers have ostensibly said the same thing. But healthcare experts and advocates, you know, they say the program is critical. They say it's crucial. There have been some lawmakers that say this lack of action is shameful. A senator referred to it as a worst-case scenario. So, you know, pretty much across the board, people want to see a solution here.
We'll continue to follow the story and see what happens. Certainly a lot of things up in the air in Washington right now as the year comes to a close. And you can hear those updates if anything happens here on Valley Public Radio. Again, healthcare reporter Carrie Klein from FM 89 talking about news about the Children's Health Insurance Program. Funding has so far lapsed. We'll see if it's renewed. Carrie, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Democratic gubernatorial candidate Delaine Easton is accusing termed-out Governor Jerry Brown of, quote, tepid leadership, especially on education. A few weeks ago, Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler sat down with her as part of their series of conversations with California's gubernatorial candidates.
Delaine Easton is a Democratic candidate for governor, former state assemblywoman, and state superintendent of public instruction. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So you served 8 years in the assembly and 8 as state superintendent of public instruction, not the best known of the statewide constitutional offices. You've been out of office for nearly 15 years. Here you are. You're running for governor. Why?
I'm running for governor because I really do believe that California is letting a lot of its citizens down in a variety of different areas, starting with education, but also including affordable housing, health care for all, transportation, infrastructure generally. And California is still the biggest state in the union, the 6th largest economy in the world, and yet we're doing tepid, timid, small things instead of really dreaming big dreams and doing the right things by kids and adults and seniors.
An increase in the minimum wage to $15 an hour? I mean, that's not necessarily tepid. There's been some also similarly big things that have come out of the state capitol in recent years.
Yes, that is a very important step in the right direction, and I applaud the legislature and the governor for doing that. Having said that, we are 41st of the 50 states in per-pupil spending, and we used to be 5th. So we've dropped to the bottom 10 of the 50 states. We live in the most expensive state in the union with the highest number and percentage of poor children. We should be in the top 10, not the bottom 10. And as you go across California, you find we have the largest class size in America. We have the fewest number of nurses, counselors, and librarians. That has consequences. And we really do need to, in fact, invest in preschool. We need to make kindergarten mandatory, and we need to invest in higher education as well as K-12. We're not doing that.
You support universal preschool, as I believe do the other three leading Democrats in the governor's race, as well as the two Democratic leaders of the state legislature. Governor Jerry Brown, however, has raised concerns over state costs. So it begs the question of how you believe the state should pay for it.
educate them or incarcerate them. We're number one in per prisoner expenditure and number 41 in per pupil expenditure. If we did more with preschool, we actually have reports and studies that have come out of our great public and private universities that tell us that if we did more with preschool, we would reduce the crime rate in California dramatically. I'm here to say, Jerry Brown said, I got kicked out of preschool, it didn't hurt me. He is the very demographic that gets the least value from preschool. His parents were well-educated and affluent. They read to him. They sang to him. He got all the benefits of preschool. We need to make sure every kid in California has that opportunity.
But it's often, as you know from your time in state government, not that easy to simply say we cut money here and we move it over there. Because, for example, with prisons, I mean, there's federal court orders that require the state to have a certain level of care and a certain level of population control there. Can you talk about whether you believe the state needs more money, needs to raise more money, or if you simply think that the money for universal preschool and some of your other priorities can be transferred out of existing programs?
Well, I think we could have, when we did the cannabis bill, we should have taxed it higher and we should have directed that money into preschool. I believe, honestly, that we could today put cannabis taxes into creating universal preschool. I called for it back in 1998 and within 10 years. That's almost 20 years ago. There's more preschool in Florida, in Georgia, and Oklahoma than there is in California. And that's a disgrace to anybody who knows the history of California. So it's time for us to step up and find a way to do this.
You've also talked about changing Proposition 13, which is often called the third rail of California politics in terms of how it's quite popular with voters. That may be changing, but there hasn't been a question asked to voters on the ballot in a while. What would you do to Prop 13 to bring more money into the state that could potentially go toward preschool?
Prop 13 was passed because so many voters had such high property taxes in their homes. And it's had a good effect overall in terms of the homeowners. But where we really have fallen down is we're not getting as much commercial and industrial property tax because many of these companies never turn over. We can and should have a conversation about reassessing commercial taxes, either reassess them when 50% plus one of the stock turns over, or create a higher level that they pay. Right now it's 1%. Everybody pays 1% of their property tax, 1% of the value of the building when it was sold. What about if it was 1.5% for commercial industrial? What about if we targeted that for education in the state of California?
That's known as a split roll, right?
Well, I think we have a split roll now. If you were married and you divorced your wife and you bought her out of her half of the house, we'd reassess that half of the house. Why don't we reassess property when 50% of the stock turns over? And beyond that, we really ought to have a conversation about what we're going to do to ensure that periodically, no matter what, commercial industrial property is reevaluated based on the value of the company.
You've spoken passionately about the need for smaller class sizes. Often school districts have to make choices about where to spend money, and often the money goes into raises or benefit increases or pensions for existing teachers. And so you've said districts shouldn't have to make that choice, but in reality right now, they do, right?
We are really not giving our kids the kind of support and scaffolding they need to live in this 21st century. Education is more important than it's ever been, and yet we're doing far less than our ancestors who came out of a depression and a war. Right now, we're wringing our hands and telling school districts, well, we're giving you more money, but we're also running up the price of the pensions. So let's find a solution here where we do, in fact, increase the per pupil spending so that we can increase the education of our children. And that should happen from preschool to graduate school.
If you were on a school board or if you were a superintendent, given the choice of increasing pay and benefits, paying pensions for existing teachers, or hiring new ones, and you only have a certain amount of money, I mean, what would you want to see the state prioritize first?
Well, I think the state has to create more resources for these school districts. The reality is that we are underfunded, dramatically underfunded. So it's like saying, which of your children will you give up? We changed Prop 13 to let you build a building locally with a 55% vote of the people. That's the construction, 55%. But it's a 66 2/3 vote to staff that building. And I'm fond of saying, if you could send your kid to a beautiful building with a lousy teacher or have your child taught by Socrates sitting on the rock, you should go with Socrates in the rock. The teacher quality is so important to us, and we have to find ways to reinvest.
But the question of whether to put money into existing teachers' salary benefits, pensions, etc., versus hiring new teachers to decrease class sizes also gets to the question about the role of teachers' unions in state politics, the influence they have. You look at the Vergara case, the court case challenging the constitutionality of California's teacher tenure and dismissal laws. School districts, administrators say, we run up against these laws all of the time. It makes it so hard for us to do the kind of educating our kids and students, particularly low-income students, suffer. Do you agree with that criticism of teachers' unions?
I'm fond of saying the floggings will continue until morale improves. You know, the reality is that teachers are so maligned and so ridiculed in this state that by some people that it just makes me crazy. You know, I know some of the teachers of the year actually think there ought to be a longer period before they're tenured. But the truth is we have such a teacher shortage right now. It's really like putting lipstick on the pig, you know. I would argue that sometimes the mediocre teacher gets kept on not because of our tenure laws, but just because there's nobody waiting in line for that job.
Or because the dismissal process is so unwieldy, it is very difficult for a district to go through the process of letting a subpar teacher go, which gets to your point about would you rather be taught by a terrible teacher in a great building or taught by Socrates on a rock?
Well, I do believe that I was in Union City and New Haven Unified 1 year, let 6 teachers go. And it was the most that any district in the state did. They had a good superintendent, and they had a good board, and they had some lousy teachers, and they got rid of them. It is doable. And Guy Emanuel was superintendent at that time, and he said to me, you know, Delaine, it's too hard, but it is doable. It's just that people have to have the will. But I would still argue that many people do not lay teachers off or remove teachers from their teaching profession because there's nobody standing in line for the job.
We're talking with Delaine Easton, who's a Democratic candidate for governor in 2018. She's a former member of the state assembly and former state superintendent of public instruction. Let's turn now to the issue of health care. You support SB 562. That's, as many listeners know, the single-payer health care bill that has stalled, for the time being at least, in the California legislature. There is a difference between universal health care and single-payer. Single-payer is when the government funds it and makes sure that it's provided to everyone, whereas universal is where everyone is covered, but maybe through a mix of government programs and the private sector. Are you open to either, or are you a straight supporter of single-payer only?
I'm open to either, but I'm riding the horse in the direction it's going. And right now what we have is an opportunity to do single-payer, and we should do it. We had a doctor come before the legislature 20 years ago. And he testified that he had saved a child's life over the weekend at the cost of over $50,000 to the state of California, when if he'd gotten $3 worth of antibiotics a day earlier, he wouldn't even have been in the emergency room. By the way, the child went deaf in that ear, lost his hearing, and so it was a lose-lose-lose for California. You know, we need comprehensive health care so that people can, in fact, do prevention. An ounce of prevention really is worth a pound of cure. We're being penny-wise and pound-foolish right now, and it's time for us to step up.
There are questions about whether it be feasible, whether you need voter approval. You certainly would need Trump administration approval, and it's not particularly seen as likely that you'd get that. But rather than trying to predict what the Trump administration would do, I guess I would ask how you believe it should be paid for if California could do that.
We are spending a fortune on emergency room visits and on care because people didn't get the preventative care. And if we did the actual cost-benefit analysis of good health care for all, I think you'd save this state a lot of money.
But aren't there some progressive groups in the healthcare realm that truly would love to make sure that everyone is covered by healthcare, but are uneasy about California shifting on its own to a single-payer system?
Well, I think if you're a smart state, you develop an alternative and you be prepared to go on your own, because I don't think Donald Trump's going to do anything for California or for this country.
Let's wrap up this interview talking about the other chief executive, the one you are seeking to replace, Jerry Brown. He's often described as the adult in the room, a fiscal moderate compared to a more liberal legislature. His state budgets have grown in size, but not nearly as much as Democratic lawmakers have pushed for. And he often vetoes bills that come with general fund costs. To what extent do you agree or disagree with that approach?
I agree with many things that Governor Brown has done fiscally as well as in terms of the environment. He has done some really important work like cap and trade. His lowest grades from me would be in education. He vetoed mandatory kindergarten, which I thought was ridiculous. He ridicules the importance of preschool and child development. When it comes to education, I would argue the last great governor of California was Pat Brown, but it's not Jerry. And Jerry needs to restore the money to child development that he's deferred paying back. He needs to give more money to K-12. And yes, we need to build more colleges and universities, make community colleges free again, and dramatically reduce tuition in the universities and build some new ones. We built 6 total campuses, 1 UC, 3 CSUs, 2 community colleges since 1965. That's 6 campuses, but 23 prisons. And I think the prisons need to be de-emphasized and not have Cadillac prisons when you have jalopy schools.
A recent poll found that half of likely California voters want the next governor to take the state in a different direction from Jerry Brown. Many of those voters are Republicans, so that part wouldn't be a surprise, but, you know, not all of them are Republicans. Do you believe California should move in a new direction? You said that the state's been taking kind of tepid steps. Has Jerry Brown been a tepid governor?
Not when it comes to cap and trade, but when it comes to education, he has been more than tepid. He has really hurt education in this state in the sense that he wasn't going to, you know, restore the funding that we got in Prop 30 from higher income taxes to schools. He hasn't been for universal preschool. He hasn't been for mandatory kindergarten. He hasn't been for reducing the cost to go to college and university. And so Jerry's marks are not high in my book when it comes to education.
All right. Delaine Easton, Democratic candidate for governor of California in 2018, former state assembly member and state schools chief. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Ben. It was a pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The San Joaquin Valley has a rich boxing tradition dating back generations. Before he ran a popular bar in downtown Fresno, young Corbett III was the world welterweight champion in the 1930s. And even today, Avenal's Jose Ramirez is one of the sport's rising stars. But at a gym in southeast Fresno, there's one local teen who hopes to go on to international fame in the sport. And it turns out she's not alone. Increasingly, Central Valley girls are dominating the teen boxing ranks nationally. Here to tell us more is journalist Megan Greenwell, who just profiled Turlock Sandra Tovar and another Fresno area boxer in the most recent edition of the California Sunday magazine. Megan, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So aside from the Tokyo dreams of Sandra Tovar, she is already a young star in her sport. Tell us a little more about what makes her so special and what she's accomplished.
Yeah, so Sandra got into boxing because her dad is a longtime boxing coach in the Central Valley, both in Turlock and at a gym in Merced. And she got into it when she was about seven. And since then, she's become the number one ranked boxer in her age and weight class in the country. She's 110 pounds and 15 years old. She'll make the cutoff to qualify for the Tokyo Olympics by one day. And I've watched her box in Fresno, and she's just a really special talent. She's very tall for a 110-pound boxer, so her reach is much longer than most of the kids she fights against. And you can see her just sort of tower above somebody. I watched her fight this boy who was the same weight exactly, but significantly shorter, and she was just literally punching down at him just repeatedly. And she's very light on her feet. She loves to run, which is actually pretty rare for a boxer. She's on her high school cross-country team at Turlock High. So you can watch her finish a three-round match, and she just never, ever gets tired. So she's really quite a talent.
Your article is not just a profile of one boxer. You're talking about an emerging trend here that is in the Central Valley, where some of the best boxers coming out of this area are girls, are women. Why are people saying this is emerging here?
Yeah, so I got interested in this story just because I was going down the national rankings of junior girl boxers, actually for a completely unrelated story. And I just kept noticing all these town names from the Central Valley. You know, you would go down the list and it would be like, the number one is from Merced and the number two is from Fresno and the number eight is from Turlock or whatever. And I just sort of went, huh, I wonder why that is. And when I started digging into it, you know, it makes some sense. The boxing tradition, as you mentioned, in the Central Valley goes back so far and goes back in California generally and so far. There are entire books written about the history of boxing in California generally. And boxing has become very dominated by Latinos in general. And so in the Central Valley, it's very much a Mexican-American tradition. And all of the girls in the national rankings right now who are from the area, they're all Latina. And almost all of them got into it because they already had some male family or friend that was involved. And so as Frank Alamon, who runs the regional boxing association and also has his own gym in Fresno, put it to me, you know, success begets success. So if you have good male fighters, you're going to end up with good female fighters too. And it didn't start to happen until about 2008. That tradition of female boxers does not go back very far, but once it started, you know, the Central Valley girls just kind of started dominating, and it's increased and increased over time.
So back to Sandra, she comes to Fresno twice a week down Highway 99 to train all the way from Turlock. Tell us a little more about that.
So she actually trains with a guy named Marcos Padilla. She trains at a boxing gym called Dethrone Boxing Gym, where they have a coach. Everybody calls him Marquitos because he's a tiny little guy. And he's become a really prominent trainer in the Fresno area. And Sandra was training with her dad in Turlock. And Fresno is a pretty long way to go for a 16-year-old who's spending all day in school. But they decided she needed some more exposure to like top-level coaching talent, but also top-level you know, kids who are also competing at the national level. And there are a lot more of those in Fresno than in Turlock. So she started commuting down like twice a week now to get that sort of exposure.
So you talked to her father, Jeff. How does he feel about his daughter following in his footsteps in boxing? Is this something that he has encouraged, or is this something that he has some misgivings about? Did he say anything about that, given what we know about the emerging science of brain research and things like CTE? Did that ever come up as a potential issue?
You know, I think he's clearly a great dad, and I think as such, he worries about his kid. He never pushed boxing on Sandra at all, even though he had been involved since the time he was a kid. He also grew up in Turlock. But when Sandra first took it up, and the only reason she took it up was because she wanted to quit her after-school program, and her mom was working full-time, and her dad was working shifts as a maintenance supervisor for the school district, but then was coaching after school. And he said, like, look, you can quit this after school program, but literally the only option we have for childcare is for you to start coming to the gym. And she said, well, okay, I'll start coming and I'll like do the running workouts and stuff like that, but I just don't want to get hit. And he said, okay, that's fine. You know, you can do everything but the fighting. And then she pretty quickly developed a taste for it and was like, well, I actually kind of want to do this after all. And he realized pretty immediately that she was some sort of special talent. He, like I say, he never really pushed it on her, but he could see, you know, she has this right jab that's just so powerful. And the way he describes it, it was so powerful even when she was a pretty little kid. And she just had a taste for it, too. She just was really, really enthusiastic about it. So he's always allowed her to do the driving. And, you know, he's very careful about not forcing too much on her. But she's really driven. She's an uncommonly driven kid in general. And once she realized that she could be, you know, competitive on the national and the international level, there was nothing that was going to stop her.
Now, I want to go back to something you mentioned just a moment ago, in that Sandra was sparring against a boy of the same weight class. Is this a co-ed sport at this level? Now, she has her eyes set on Tokyo Olympics, and women's boxing is now an official sport there. How does it work in this amateur level?
So in competition, no matter what level it's happening, whether it's just a little local tournament or on the international level, you only fight against members of your same gender. So formally, she only competes against other girls. There still are many fewer girls competing, even in the Central Valley, than there are boys. And particularly, you know, at the level that Sandra is at, you can't throw her in the ring with any 110-pound kid because they're just not going to be able to keep up with her at all. So she does a lot of her sparring against boys, and she also trains against girls who are heavier than she is, because she's on the lighter side of things for a 15-year-old. So America Berber, who's the other girl profiled in my story, she's a 125-pound boxer, and she and Sandra actually spar against each other because, like, you know, that's sort of what you need to do to get that level of training. And they both get something out of it because America is used to fighting people who are a little bit bigger and thus a little bit slower. And so Sandra's speed is really useful for her. And meanwhile, Sandra gets to go up against somebody who hits significantly harder than most 110-pounders.
So we hear that Sandra has her sights set on Tokyo in 2020. She will just qualify for that by one day with her birth date requirement. But what does America have in her future? It sounds like she has a little bit different course forward from your article.
Yeah, so America also takes the sport incredibly seriously. Though both girls are 15, they're actually 9 months apart. So America will be too young to qualify for Tokyo. So she's thinking about potentially the 2024 Olympics. But, you know, she's also not totally sure what her future in the sport is in the same way that Sandra is. In boxing, you can pursue the amateur path and go to the Olympics. You can also go straight pro and never compete at the Olympic level at all. And America is open to both of those paths. She takes school really, really seriously. She's a freshman this year, and she is not sure how she can balance boxing with going to college. So the national championships are this week in Salt Lake City. Sandra is there. America is not there because her parents were not comfortable with her missing that much school. And, you know, the financial realities of this sport are also incredibly intense for kids who don't come from super affluent backgrounds. And there are efforts to raise money, but it can't cover everybody. And so I think America, you know, like I say, she's 9 months younger. I think she's still kind of trying to figure out everything a little bit more than Sandra is, being almost a full year older. But talent-wise, she certainly has the ability to compete on that level as well. She's been second in the last 2 years Junior Olympics, and she's ranked third in her weight class right now. So if she decides she wants to keep at it at that level, she can absolutely do it.
We've been talking with journalist Megan Greenwell, who just wrote this piece in the California Sunday Magazine about how female teen boxers in the Central Valley are dominating their sport. And you can find it online as well in California Sunday Magazine. Megan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, send us an email with your thoughts, talk@kvpr.org, and subscribe to our Valley Edition podcast online on the website as well. For Valley Edition reporters Carrie Klein and Laura Tsutsui, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. The California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.